the jam band phenomenon refuses to die. Now, despite the success of neat and tidy folkies such as Avril Lavigne and David Gray, this winter has seen a reuniting of the band Phish at an overwhelmingly successful New Year's Eve show in New York and on television Saturday Night Live. There was a third album and concerts by Rusted Root, and a new incarnation of the mother of all jam bands, the Grateful Dead. The first time since Jerry Garcia died in 1995, the surviving members of the Dead, Bob Weir, Phil Lesh, Mickey Hart, and Bill Kreutzmann, have played dates together around the country. They call themselves the Other Ones, no doubt because they're minus the mournful wail of Mr. Garcia's guitar. Dennis McNally, longtime Grateful Dead publicist, friend, and official historian, has written a new book about the band. It's called A Long Strange Trip, The Inside History of the Grateful Dead. Dennis McNally joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Dennis, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
You know, inevitably we referred to Jerry Garcia as being at the center of most people's consciousness of the Grateful Dead. Mm-hmm. This being said, inside that band, was Jerry Garcia the ringleader?
Only by example. Jerry set a lot of style, but the style he set was anarchism, and he refused to lead. The only decisions he really made was sort of very right at the beginning, which was to say that it was going to be a real democracy, that if it wasn't unanimous, one loud no was a veto.
How did the band ever get together?
Well, most of them were involved at the very beginning in teaching, or in the case of Ron Pigpen McKernan, who was the first vocalist and keyboard player, he was the janitor at a music store. And Phil Lesh was a jazz trumpeter and avant-garde composer that they sort of drafted. So they all came from very different musical worlds, and sort of intuitively within the first few months of being the Warlocks at first and then the Grateful Dead, they decided they were going to play with true improvisation. And when I say that, I mean almost going back to Dixieland style. Every musician improvising, not four guys laying down a tight groove and somebody soloing over it. There was a nodding acquaintance with the melody, but there were times when they were going in six directions, and yet, hopefully, parallel, because, of course, to improvise at all, you've got to listen to each other. And they created this. It's not exactly rock and roll. They could rock, but it wasn't really rock and roll. It's what I call 21st century electronic American string band music. It was something altogether different.
Why do you think, Dennis, that the Dead lasted as a living, breathing entity that toured and recorded in a way, certainly the Doors or Jefferson Airplane or Big Brother and the Holding Company, the other great Bay Area bands didn't?
Well, fortunately, they only had one hit, and it came late, so they never were cursed with having too much money and the squabbles that brings. They didn't get involved with the whole recording business all that much. They made records, some of them good, some of them not. But their get-off, their inspiration, was playing for people. Beside that, because they improvised, it truly improvised, it was fresh every night. Sometimes it was great, sometimes it was awful, but it was always at least a new challenge and a new adventure every night. And that kept them going very strong for 30 years.
Where's the name come from?
Phil Lesh was in a record store and saw a recording attributed to the Warlocks, some other Warlocks. So we need a new name. And they went through 100, none of them worked. And finally, Jerry Garcia stuck his finger in a dictionary, God's truth, and it landed on the phrase Grateful Dead, which is a leitmotif, a theme in folk tales and folk songs that goes back 5,000 years to the Egyptian. And a traveler is traveling along, encounters a corpse not getting a proper burial because it owes debts. He pays the corpse's debts, usually with his last dime. And the spirit of the corpse, now grateful because his karma has been resolved, comes back, usually in the form of an animal, and helps him out in whatever his life needs. what it's about is not really about death or and certainly not about morbidity. It's about cast thy bread upon the waters and you'll get it back a thousandfold. It's about ethics, actually.
Talk about their music for a bit. Bob Weir, Jerry Garcia, Phil Lesh, they wrote music, not lyrics.
Exactly. Their lyricist, Robert Hunter, was the final piece in the puzzle that made them really become fully the Grateful Dead. In that regard, my favorite story of mutual great inspiration, Jerry was driving across a bridge into Marin County from the East Bay of California, San Francisco, and there's a big storm, and as he was going across the bridge, a song entered his mind, and I mean, it was great. He knew this was worth keeping. He drove home instantly, sat down with a tape recorder, and laid down the chord changes. The same day, at his home, looking out on the bay, within sight of that bridge, Robert Hunter saw the storm and got inspired to write a 10-page poem. The next day, Jerry goes over to Hunter's house and says, "Listen to this, I got a great song." Hunter says, "That's funny." So he wrote 10 pages. They took pages 1, 2, and part of 10, and the result was a song called Terrapin Station. And it is, if I say so, a modest masterpiece.
Interestingly, for a group that was so overwhelmingly associated with a certain social ideal, they were not a particularly political group, were they?
Oh, no, just the reverse. Yeah. The Grateful Dead served as the soundtrack to a dozen anti-war fundraising events and rallies, and yet they would never put the name Grateful Dead into association with any cause. It was for music and only music, and Garcia felt that the music could be trusted. Anything else was suspect.
I'd like you to tell me the story, if you could, of how the song The Other One came to be written.
Well, Bob Weir sort of heard something in his head. Actually, it was a take. It started from a Yardbirds riff. And he started working with it and working with it and working with it. Then Mickey Hart joined the band. And suddenly you had polyrhythms because you had two drummers. So one guy was playing fours and one guy was playing threes, and it got immensely complicated. To me, there's the basic lick, rhythm in rock and roll called the Bo Diddley lick, which is shave and a haircut, two bits, which is Not Fade Away and Bo Diddley and dozens of songs, really. This adds something else because it's a polyrhythm, and it's an absolutely universal groove. It is a monstrous groove, and they took it in amazing places. Then, this was before Hunter was a regular lyricist, Weir started writing the lyrics. And he wrote one that was about the time he threw a water balloon at a cop and got arrested, and that didn't really work. And finally, one night, he started thinking, he'd recently been hanging around with Neil Cassidy, who was Dean Moriarty and On the Road and was their good friend. And he started thinking about Neil, and he wrote the lyrics, "The bus came by and I got on, that's when it all began, it was Cowboy Neil at the wheel of the bus to never ever land." He went, I like this. And then the next day he found out that Neil had just died in Mexico, walking along railroad tracks of exposure, and their hero was gone. That weird synchronicity, those sorts of slightly cosmic events are kind of standard fare.
Was the band happy together in the 1990s?
Not entirely, because everyone could see that Garcia's health was poor. that, you know, such drug use as he involved in was mostly to mask real increasing physical problems. Diabetic problems, which he didn't really address properly. He had congestive heart failure resulting from years of... He's still smoking. He still, you know, ate cheeseburgers and a horrible diet. He exercised only fitfully. So in the end, that tainted the atmosphere. I mean, for anyone who's ever wondered, you know, experienced it, having a close friend who's got a drug problem and a general health problem, if they don't want to change, if they don't want to acknowledge that they've got a problem, it's very difficult to get through.
I'm going to ask you, Dennis, to risk a historical guess. I usually don't like to put people in this position, but if Jerry Garcia had not died, you think the band would still be together?
If he had not died, which is to say, if he had really committed himself to health, I would say yes, because the creative rapport had not gone away, as The Ride of the Other Ones proves 7 years later. Garcia did joke while he didn't necessarily want to try and compete with Duke Ellington, the Duke Ellington Orchestra, for longevity records, he did anticipate the idea of playing the New Year's Eve 1999. Seemed like a good goal.
Dennis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dennis McNally, speaking with us from San Francisco. His new book is called A Long Strange Trip, The Inside History of the Grateful Dead. An excerpt from the book, plus links to the Grateful Dead, can be found at www.npr.org. Clocks are running late. Paint by the morning sky looks so phony. Dawn is breaking everywhere. By the candle, curse the glare. Draw the curtains, I don't care, 'cause it's all right. And this is Weekend Edition, directed by Charlie Mayer and produced by Sarah Beyer. Kelly Bridget McCarthy, Sarah Beyer, Grateful Deadhead Kelly, Bridget McCarthy, Ed McNulty, Darf C. Bacon, Eric Greenwald, Andy Lyman, Julia Bailey, and our new intern, Diana Douglas, out of BYU. Our technical director is Burke Hunn, so ably assisted by Stu Rushfield, Andrea Jackson-Gortz, Ted Mebane, and Greg Gavin. Our librarians are Kim Alesky, Alphonse Veen, and Holly Witt. Our senior editor is Gwendolyn Tompkins, and the senior producer of Weekend Edition Saturday is Peter Breslow. 11-year-old Matthew Kaufman of New York City. Good to know you're listening. I'm Scott Simon.